Blog Talk Radio.
There's a direct relationship between having the businesses and being in prison. Go find an Asian, see how many Asians you can find in American prisons. They ain't gonna be in there. But 51% of your prison will be black because blacks don't have any businesses and industries. There's a direct link. Blacks won't practice group economics. Blacks won't practice group politics. If you don't practice, you're setting yourself up. I told that five-story building, you're setting yourself to get wiped out. Understand the nature of race, which is economics. If you build the first floor, it's economic. Build your businesses and your industries. Control business and industry, and put that pulls in your money, and hold that money, and practice group economics with it. Arab and Asian money bounces 12 or 13 times for a lead. Jewish money bounces 18 times. Black folks got to learn how to practice group economics. Black Americans spend every penny they get outside their own community. Then you take the money and the wealth that you get from that first floor and go to the second floor. The second floor is politics. You then take that money on the first floor and you control your politics. Black folk must quit allowing people to tell them to go out and vote. Vote for what? Nobody's going to do anything for black folk in politics. Politics is controlled by money. Major corporations, who got the money? That's what controls politics. If you have no money, you have no say-so, you have no benefits coming. So you take your money and you control and you take your money on the first floor, you buy every politician on the second floor. And any politician you can't buy, you rent or lease them to get what you need. Then once you get the second floor under control with the politician, with your money, then you go to the third floor. The third floor then is the police department and the court system. You take your money from the first floor and your politics on the second floor and you control the court system and the police department. Then the fourth floor, then is media. You then take the money that you generate off the first floor from business and industries and you go after radio stations, TV stations, newspapers, and cable systems so that you can now inform and communicate with your own people. Right now, black folk own and control less than 35 thousandths of 1% of the media in the United States. Out of 12,000 radio stations, black folk own about 75 or 80. That's all. You own no cable systems. You don't have a daily newspaper. You have nothing of importance. You got about one black TV station. So you can't communicate with your people. You can't inform your people. You can't do anything. You can have Rush Limbaugh and all the rest of the guys talking about racism all day long and bad-mouthing you. And O'Reilly, they can call black folk all kind of names all day long. What are you going to do? You can't respond. You can't communicate with your own people because you don't have an economic base. 51% of all the prisons in the United States are black people. You only make up 12% of the population. That's no accident. It's because you don't control the economics and the politics. And they're going to go after the weakest people they can get their hands on to incarcerate. That's the black folk. And what are you going to do in response to them when they over-incarcerate you? You're going to go out and have a march, a demonstration. We're going to march. March, who cares? Marching has never changed anything.
Many a young athlete entertains hoop dreams. Few, if any, have tried as hard to make them come true as the kid our Steve Hartman has gone to see.
Every week, he set himself up for disappointment. Every week, 13-year-old Jamarian Stiles came to this community center in Boca Raton, Florida, hoping to play basketball with the other kids. And every week, he was rejected.
They'll start picking teams, and I would be the only one left out. And then they'll just tell me, just go home and stuff. You can break someone's heart like that.
The problem was obvious to everyone but Jamarian. He lost his hands and most of his arms as an infant due to a rare bacterial infection. But he insisted that was no reason to give up his hoop dreams.
What about soccer? Have you heard of that sport?
Yeah, hear it every day.
Why don't you play soccer? That just seems like the obvious thing.
You would think that I would be good at soccer. I'm really not. I'm horrible.
Which is why, on the first day of class here at Eagles Landing Middle School, Jamarian took his case to basketball coach Darian Williams.
Yeah.
Said he wanted to be on the team this year.
I said, all great, well, just make sure you try out.
He said, okay, great, but what are you really thinking?
This man has no arms.
Yeah.
How is he going to play basketball? But man, he told me, Mr. Williams, I've never been on a team before. Even if I don't play, I just want to be on the team. And how could I say no to that?
And that's how the Eagles got their first armless basketball player. Jamarian, number two there, quickly earned a reputation as the hardest worker on the squad.
He was usually the first one in the gym, usually the last one to leave.
Still, he sat on the bench most of the season.
Try one more.
Until last month. Coach put him in the game with about 6 minutes left. And when he eventually got the ball on the far side of the court, everyone yelled, shoot it! So he did. And sank. A three-pointer. And if you didn't quite see that, don't worry. Because shortly after, he got the ball again. This time on the near side. For another three-pointer. At the buzzer. Jamarian Stiles. The kid no one would pick. Was now everyone's hero. Needless to say, today, Jamarian can play all he wants at the community center. He just made the volleyball team and has every intention of playing football next year. Really, the only thing he won't play is the victim.
If I could wave a magic wand right now and give you your arms back, would you want them?
I don't need them.
You don't need them?
No.
Who needs hands when you've got this kind of touch?
Now, learn this from Joel Osteen. That's my man. He be texting me. That's my man. This God done put some people around me, show me some stuff. He was telling this story. He said, this man that went to heaven, he was walking with Peter down this aisleway, and it was going down this corridor, had a lot of doors on it, and said all these doors had names on it. And he said, Peter, let me ask you something. What's all these doors, these names on? He said, don't worry about it. Just go ahead. So he kept walking. And he messed around. He saw one of them doors and had his name on it. He said, whoa. He said, hey, Peter, this here ain't got my name on it. Something I need to know? He said, man, don't worry about that. You here now. Just go on in there and talk to him. See what he's here. He said, nah, I won't know what's in the door. He said, you sure you won't see what's in the door? He said, yeah. So he opened up the door. It was a warehouse. It had nothing but shelves on it. And then the shelves had nothing but packages. And all the packages had his name on them. And he said, what is all these boxes? He said, that's all of the blessings. All of the things God wanted to ship to you. But number one, you didn't ask him for it. Then number two, you didn't believe you would have it. Then you doubted him. And then you felt like you wasn't worthy. And so now all these boxes is up here. Now the man standing there wishing he had never even been in the room. And I started thinking. I got some dudes that work for me. And I said, I want you to do this graph for me. And that's what I'm finna show you now. See, what you happen is when God sends your package, he only sends it to one street. That's Faith Street. You got to stay in faith. You can't move off of Faith Street. You can't get on Doubted Drive. You can't be over there and start doubting it because your package going to go right on by. You can't lose your faith and get on not meant to be way, because your package is going to keep going right on by. Because the package just go to Faith Street. You can get your little feelings hurt, I ain't worthy. Guess what? Your package going to keep going right on by. You have not because you ask not. Then you sit up here and start feeling sorry for yourself. You go on pity way, your package keep going right on by. If you stay right on Faith Street, don't ever come off, because the blessing is coming. If you wait on it, here it comes. It may not come when you want it, but it on time. But if you get up and you move off of Faith Street, your box gonna get sent back to sender. And now you're gonna have a warehouse with a bunch of boxes with your name on it that you didn't never get. And I don't know about you, but I want everything he got for me. If he got something for me, I need all of mine. Because I don't know about you, but God lay you out, man. God will give you stuff. Man, he done took me places. I ain't never thought I was going to go. I done seen parts of the world I never even thought I could go to. He done gave me stuff. He done put people in my life. God will do it for you, man. But you just got to stay, man. Use these principles of success. Understand, God is just that way. He'll lay you out. Because if he can lay me out, see, if he fix me and change me and get me over here trying to do better, I ain't perfect. I'm just trying to do better. I still say some stuff I ain't supposed to say. You understand? I ain't got it all together yet. I just got in the gate. I'm a new kind of Christian. But ain't no lock on my gate either. So if you see, once you check me, I'm probably going to check you back. But I'm getting better at that. I don't know how to love my enemies yet. I'm getting better at it, though. But it's a process. And the more times we can make people understand that it's a process, the more people can come in. And y'all people that have been good to me, that have been praying for me. I mean, man, my mama, if she could see me now, I just wish my mama could see me. Because she been praying for this hill all her life. Watch my son. Well, he done watched me, mama. And I'm cool now. And my philosophy is very simple. I was who I was, but I am who I am. And I'm cool with both them people. Because who I was wasn't that bad chap. I made some mistakes, but I've been changed a little bit. And it's still a process. And the more people that you invite into the process, the better this is. Because ain't nobody perfect no how. So I really appreciate y'all, man, hearing me and listening to me. I'm going to ask Kirk Franklin if he will come.
All right, Kirk Franklin ain't coming in this morning. All right, here we go with It's My House. Today's live stream, we're doing a continuation from yesterday. Today's podcast is titled The Promised Land Ain't in Egypt, Part 2. And it's just like that. The Promised Land Ain't in Egypt, Part 2. And this title was inspired by a conversation that I heard early yesterday morning on Clubhouse, where what was the question that they asked? Is there any hope? I'm paraphrasing. Any hope for Black Americans in the United States? I'm paraphrasing that. So when I hear that, and I was listening to the conversation, I said, you know what? A lot of these people don't know African-American history, because there are communities in the United States where Black folks for the last 100 years or so haven't had no racial problems or nothing like that. So and a question was posed to me yesterday on, like, for instance, one of the things we're going to talk about today is Black Townships versus Black Wall Street, and that will deal with, because typically when victim stories come out with Black folks, you know, they bring up Black Wall Street, they bring up Rosewood. And what we're going to go through today also is if you, because there are new towns coming up every day. Well, not every day, but every year there are new towns that pop up on the map of the United States as well as other countries around the world. So anybody within the sound of my voice, you can search your own town. But today, here's what we have. We have a guest calling in from what I call a promised land. We're going to talk about Mount Bayou, Mississippi, which I consider that a promised land for African Americans. Then there's Promised Lands USA. We'll go through other towns in the U.S. and the United States that I consider promised lands. Promised Lands Canada, Promised Lands Mexico. These are places where black folks went from the Underground Railroad and then immediately after slavery was abolished in what we now call the United States. These are places where black folks went to experience the optimum freedom for their time being. I mean, where they went, they built their own communities where there was no lynching, kids were safe to play, they had their own economies and things of that nature. Defending your promised land. Every time I hear about Black Wall Street or Rosewood, nobody ever brings up the topic on prevention. Could they have done in the planning of that community to defend it? And then we're going to go through what I would call defending your promised land or promised land chess strategies. In the game of chess, you know, you have multiple strategies. You know, you got to have offensive moves, you got to have defensive moves. If you're just sitting there like if you build something and don't have multiple strategies on how to defend it, okay, and that's where we're going to go back. I don't think you're only, when it comes to defending, laying down your life is just one option. I don't call it a defense, but it might be an option. But to look at the board game of chess, because in the chess game, you have multiple defenses. You just don't have one. You have multiple defenses. And I've never heard anybody talk about, you know, what they could have done with Black Wall Street, the Greenwood neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma. What could they have done? What could they have planned in advance? What kind of multiple strategies could they plan in defense to protect that community? You know, what were the multiple defense options that they have politically? What multiple, and there's a whole list of items that we can go through on that, just on the political defense. What kind of options, what kind of defense did they have when it comes to law enforcement? What kind of defense did they have with the judicial system? What kind of defense did they have for you know, being armed? What kind of defense did they have and in place? All right. Imagine if they had at least 10 strategies for the four categories that I just named. That's 40 different defensive strategies that they could have had that, matter of fact, in some cases, you know what, another one, social capital. So you got, they could have had 50, at least 50 different defensive strategies in five different categories that you have in your planning stage. And O.W. Gurley was the developer of Black Wall Street because he bought 40 acres. He could have, that's what that community could have had, but they didn't have. And then there's some other strategies that we can also lump in there, because the way they did it was You know, they went in and looted houses. You know, we can add on probably another 50 strategies on top of that. So if you got a community, you need to have a committee and look at what are the various ways that we can protect our communities and come up with 100 different strategies in at least 10 different categories. 10 defensive strategies. And in that way, you're playing chess. It looks like the people of Black Wall Street, no disrespect, they were playing checkers, and they weren't even prepared to play checkers. And that's what happened. I mean, it happened. Now, but we'll go through that because their black townships, they played the game. Their defense strategy was based on geography. The black townships of Oklahoma, of which Black Wall Street was not, because Black Wall Street was a neighborhood within the city of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The black townships of Oklahoma, what they did was they used geography. They said, let's strategically move away from as far as we can from Tulsa, Oklahoma. All right, way outside the city limits. And establish our own places in geographical areas that are not easy to get to. Now, I'm basing that on the three black townships that I've been to Taft, Oklahoma, several times. I mean, that would be home base for me out in Oklahoma, Taft. Summit, Oklahoma, I've been there at least twice. And Tallahassee, Oklahoma, I've been there once. All right. All three of those places... In 2022 right now, unless you know specifically how to get to those places, you're not going to find them, but particularly Summit. And particularly, matter of fact, at night, you can go through each one of those towns and never know you went through a town. That's at night. And if you're walking, like in Summit, Oklahoma, You'll be alone and lost. But anyway, so we'll get through all that. And we have a guest, like I said, we call him for. We're going to talk about Mount Bayou now. Let me explain this title once again. The Promised Land ain't in Egypt. If we go back to the Old Testament or the Jewish Torah. The Promised Land, all right, was in Egypt. The Promised Land was not in Egypt. But Egypt at that time, and I'm putting this in the context, was, in today's term, we would call it the grid. You know, Cairo, Memphis, they had the schools, they had the universities, they had the temples, they had the commerce. You know, they had a downtown marketplace. All right. These were the metropolitan or the urbanized area of the ancient world. All right. And in these places, all right, is people gravitate to these then as well as now, they gravitate to these larger cities because larger cities, larger communities have the comfort and conveniences of daily living. I mean, in Cairo, in 3100 BC or whatever, because it's over 3,000 years older than the United States, even. So in Cairo or Memphis, you had people just like today. Let's compare it to Chicago or New York. You have a lot of people, matter of fact, let's take gentrification. One of the reasons why gentrification happens here in the United States, and let's say it's gentrification of, and let's base it off the film Flag Wars, where you had a white gay population in Columbus, Ohio. They moved into abandoned parts or parts of Columbus, Ohio. I mean, they were just convenient. I mean, they can buy a place in Columbus or it could be Chicago, or it could be Detroit, or any major city of any major size, they can buy something and they can walk to work, or they can bike to work, or they can take a bus or the metro to work. You know, shopping, everything they might need is when maybe a quarter mile or a half mile or maybe a mile or no more than a 10-mile radius, actually it's probably a 5-mile radius or less, from where they sleep at night. And that's today. So it's the same thing that happened over 3,000 years ago in Egypt. And when it comes to Cairo and Memphis and your larger ancient urbanized cities for that time, all right? And you had, now, that culture had slaves, but let me give you the full context of the word slave. Slave was basically a term used for the working man or woman. They were wage slaves. Entrepreneurs or business owners, they measure their pay in profits, and there's more money in profits than in wages. All right. So, and Pharaoh was the government. Today, you have government, local, state, and federal. All right. So as far as this goes, Pharaoh was the government. All right. Taxation and, you know, rules and, you know, just like, you know, if you go to New York City today, it's a highly regulated city because you have over 8 million people that live in that city. The larger the population, the more rules and regulations, which means more government. However, if you go to upstate New York and you go to a town that's got less than 1,000 people, then there's dramatically less rules and regulations and more freedom. All right, that's in 2022. Apply the same thing back then. So the Moses and the Hebrews, they wanted freedom. They wanted to get to their promised land. But in order for them to do that, they would have to leave the comfort and conveniences of Egypt. Just like in 2022, if you want to see a dramatic fall in the shootings of black men by the police or incarcerations of black people by the police, or you want to get away from redlining and what you call white supremacy, if you want to get, you need to get away from the Egypt of the day. Now, the Egypts of the day in the United States are the Chicagos, are the New Yorks, are the Bostons, are the D.C., are the Seattles, the Miamis, the Orlandos, those large cities. And then your promised land will be in rural areas. 86% of the population of the United States occupies only 5% of the landmass. That's the Egypt here in the United States. Once you step out into the rural areas, and 92% of black people in the United States live in Egypt in the United States, we're all crammed into that little 5% landmass. 95% of the United States is rural. It's rural. Next time you get in the plane, you know, after a few minutes, and it won't be long, you know, you, matter of fact, you pull up out of New York City, Chicago, you know, Midway, what's that other airport up in Chicago? Midway, O'Hare. LA, pull up, maybe not even 5 minutes. Once you pull up, you know, you get above 3,000 feet or whatever, you're going to see just land. And you might see a house here and there, but you'll just see land. 95% of the United States is basically rural. 22% of that is wilderness. In 2022, there are parts of the United States that man has not even set foot in yet, and we're over 200 years old. These are promised land areas. Now, before I go to the phone lines here, what I guess, a person that I brought up yesterday is Isaiah Montgomery. And you can look him up online on Wikipedia. Isaiah Thornton Montgomery, he was born May 21st, 1847, and he transitioned March 5th, 1924. He was the founder of Mount Bayou, Mississippi, an all-black community. He was a Republican, and he was a delegate to the 1890 Mississippi Constitutional Convention, and he served as mayor as Mount Bayou, Mississippi. Now, let's get into his early life. Now, this is the fascinating part. Okay. Born into slavery. His picture is on Wikipedia. Isaiah Thornton Montgomery. He was born into slavery. Isaiah was the son of Ben Montgomery, a slave owner, and a slave owner, Joseph Davis, promoted him to overseer. Now, that was his dad. The younger Montgomery, we're talking about Isaiah, learned to read and write due to his father's influential position at Davis Bend Plantation. His father, Ben Montgomery, ended up owning a plantation. His father, Ben Montgomery, born a slave, ended up owning a plantation. Now, later on, he lost it because he couldn't keep up the payments. But for a little while, he had a plantation that he owned, and that was his personal promised land. But his son went one step above that. All right, Davis wanted to establish more positive working environment for slaves and encourage education. All right, long story short, what Isaiah Montgomery did is he went out into the wilderness of Northwest Mississippi. And if you look up Mount Bayou, Mississippi, there's a map of it. And he purchased, for those of you who think slaves never were paid, once again, if you're going to use the word slave, the full context of it is wage slave, just not slave, wage slaves. Past the boat getting over here from Africa, particularly the ones that were born in this country, I would say a good portion of the slaves were paid. That's how many of them purchased their freedom. So Isaiah Montgomery, what he did was he took his earnings and he bought his freedom, and then he purchased I believe 500 and initially 561 acres of land. That is his promised land. He didn't, now this was in Mississippi. He didn't go to Jackson, Mississippi. See, that's somebody else's promised land. And that's where a lot of, in my opinion, I'm just one person, in my opinion, that's where a lot of black folks, particularly the youngins, get caught up today, particularly with this reparation stuff. You stop counting other people's money. Stop looking at other people's wealth. Medgar Evers got assassinated in Jackson, Mississippi, which was somebody else's promised land. Isaiah Montgomery got his own promised land with that 561 acres, and he had other people help him develop the town. So Mount Bayou, Mississippi is a community that is still around today, and to my knowledge, it has never had any racial violence. To my knowledge, but anyway, we're going to bring somebody on that actually knows about Mount Bayou. So let's go to the phone lines right now. 773, your mic is open. Good morning.
Good morning. Are you addressing me? Can you hear me all right?
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. Good morning, Delmar.
Yep. Yes, welcome. Yes, thank you.
Well, now you're from out Bayou. Tell us about what you. Okay, you grew up there, so give us the backstory on Mount Bayou. I haven't been there yet.
Okay, I was born in 46, and of course my birth certificate is listed in Whistleville, which when you talk about Mount Bayou, you had these little towns around there, Whistleville, Wyandotte, Marigold, Cleveland, Shelby. These are all walking distance towns there from Mount Bayou. But our lifestyle where I lived, which was not in the city, but again, I was basically born in a cotton field because there was cotton raised on all four sides, there's little four of them out. So I was born there. But again, growing up in Mount Bayou, that was the town where we got our substance and our visit there with my dad. That's where the cotton gin was. In fact, the Conwells were cousins to my dad. They owned the cotton gin. So that's where we visit most often and all that thing. So Mount Bayou was the town that I know more about as a child going to it for things than, say, other. But we went to Shelby, went to other towns, went to Cleveland. But again, Mount Bayou was the all-black town. And I'm just looking at, again, my computer here. It states that, again, July 1887 was founded. And so we're talking about from 1887 to the late 40s, 46, 47, 50s. I lived there until I was about 11, 57. I moved away from there. So,
okay. Well, now, from what your memory, I mean, as far as feeling safe there, crime or racial tensions, I mean, what was the atmosphere there like there?
Mount Bayou was definitely a safe haven. It was the promised land, you said, for blacks. I remember watching a long series on public broadcast, name just slipped me here, the famous Dr. Dozer. He did a series from DeSalvo to Obama, but he covered Mount Bayou. And again, you never heard the N-word, as they said. That just didn't happen. That was a place where if you were there, you were treated with respect. And I never grew up hearing that word from anyone in that community. We didn't even say it about each of us, for joke or nothing else. It was never used in my upbringing. It was only when the height of the thrust of the racial tension that broke out later on that this word became permanent. And then, of course, some of our noted people started to apply to us for money, a joke, whatever. But no, that was definitely a place where living in Mount Bayou, we were independent. We had the school, the hospital, the doctor, the food supply, everything was there. We were independent. Like I said, we even had our own cotton gin. So it was an independent town. Post office, everything was there in that town.
So yeah, black. So you had your own, so to speak, economy there, black economy. Entrepreneurs,
right,
and everything.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Now, these other towns that you mentioned, what were they like?
Well, again, smaller than Mount Bayou, but they were, again, a cluster of black people. They didn't have the municipal structure that Mount Bayou had. They were considered towns, but again, Mount Bayou was the big brother, or the one that was over all of them, and given the start date, 1887, I didn't look up the others, but I imagine they were towns that were started later than that.
Right.
But they
see,
were
that's
not
why
as
I like visiting. I like, because I know when I went to Taft, Oklahoma, there's a town, you're not going to find it on the radar, but it exists because I've set foot in it three or four times already. Blackjack, Oklahoma. It doesn't have a municipal structure. It's unincorporated, but they've got a community that's been there for over 100 years, probably predating statehood of Oklahoma. So when I hear you talk about that, it's, you know, those communities that you're just talking about that are connected to Mount Bayou, a lot of people don't know about those communities, which I would call those promised lands as well.
And by the way, you remember that the main transportation was 61 Highway, went straight through Mound Bayou. But these towns, again, Wyandotte, Chambers, Marigold, they were also on that same stretch of Mound Bayou, I mean, Highway 61. Mm-hmm. But they didn't have the they didn't have gas station stuff where you stop. You wasn't, you know, you just drive right through them unless you had some reason to deal with somebody. They didn't have the things to stop and do business with that Mound Bayou had. Mound Bayou again was the actual big brother town that was independent there, recognized.
Now the town's
black community.
Yeah, it was founded in 1887, so the town is over 100 years old. It was founded in 1887, and it was incorporated in 1898. Why do you think the and it reached city status on May 12, 1972? Why do you think the success of it? You know, what do you attribute the success to? It's not a fly-by-night town. It's there, and it's got over 1,000 people that live there. Matter of fact, over 15, right here says 1,534 people live in Mount Bayou. So what do you think, the success of that, there's been a successful community for over a year, 100 years.
Okay. I'm glad you asked that question because I did do my homework. In fact, I had done it before, and then I went back and did a review. And by the way, the information has changed. there was no Wikipedia, 30, 40 years ago?
Right.
But let me tell you the information that I read. In fact, my last visit where I took my oldest son there to tour the town, just kind of look at things. We actually went in and talked to Jim, who was the self-appointed local librarian. He was an elderly man. He knew the history. He lived there, and he had all the paperwork and his documents and things to cite it. But my reading, when I first actually got into reading about Mound Bayou, say 50 years ago or so, stated that, again, as I'm looking at this monument that's still there, it talks about Joe Davis, who had conceived this idea before the Civil War, that there should be an independent black community. And that wasn't a new idea. And back at the time I read this, the information said there were two projects to establish that. The first one failed and Mound Bayou succeeded. So it wasn't just something that just happened. There was a plan. By the way, my reading also, and I went to did research yesterday of the Joe Davis, and it states here that Isaiah was the ex-slave of, was the brother of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederacy.
Right.
So this interesting story, I pulled it up, and so there was this, I guess, different philosophy about slavery somewhat, or who the people were from the two brothers, which a big family. They were a family of 10, and they had several brothers. Three of the brothers fought in the Civil War, in the War of 1812. So they were a military family, by the way, the Davis were. So the idea of what happened there, based on what I had read before, and I think it's still true, this was a design project. It wasn't something that just happened, and it was just like just luck or something, but it was designed to create an independent ex-slave community. I'm not saying the word black, but they wasn't used then. It was a negative word by then, of course.
Right.
So, It happened by design, and it stayed by design, and I believe that one of the reasons that kept it strong was the presence of what we call segregation. And that we thrived on that in Mound Bayou. You know, have that independence and that unity, and even going back to the period I grew up where at the end of the year, at the fall of the year, in fact, when the end of the season, when all the all the farmers would come together and gather their crops and slay the animals and put aside their meat and store their food for the winter. That was done as a community, and we did it together. Mm-hmm. So nobody needed anything in their community because everybody worked together to share resources. So we were strong. We weren't just isolated. It was a strong community. And I cannot remember anybody not working. Everybody worked. There was no welfare. You worked. You didn't have people laying around living off somebody else. It just wasn't part of the culture. So we had to strive and work together, and that made us strong. And the opposite of that, of course, right now is now that everybody pursued, almost everybody, now that people pursue the concept of integration, which divided us, scattered us, and now you have entirely different neighborhoods of black people where they're preying on each other. And in fact, there seems to be more pressure toward the racial tension now than it was in Mount Baya. So that's a big difference
okay.
from what I'm seeing today from what I grew up with. So to answer your question, it stuck because there were principles in place of independence and staying together and working together and doing things together, and that passed down. Now, of course, you hadn't asked the question yet. We're going to get to what happened after segregation?
Yeah, you're
and after immigration
that.
Came in, we're going to get to that. I'll let you lead that if you want to. I'll tell you
what
the difference is now than it was then.
Well, let's put it this way. All right, let's lead. Now, Medgar Evers, who was a civil rights activist,
right.
and whatnot. He was assassinated in Jackson, Mississippi. Now, I would call Jackson, why he chose to live in Jackson, I don't know. Maybe we can get his widow on here, Marilee Everett. She's remarried, but anyway, I think she's still living. Maybe we can get her on here one day.
Mississippi, remember that?
Yeah.
This is the capital.
Well, he was assassinated.
It was a bigger metropolis.
Right. He was assassinated, and I call that Egypt. He was assassinated in Jackson, which was, like you said, because Egypt was a metropolis. All right. So, which I call somebody else's promised land, whereas in Mount Bayou, and these other satellite communities that you grew up around or in. And there's a whole bunch of them across the United States. I mean, Martin Luther King, he was assassinated in what I would call Memphis, Tennessee, was what I would call in Egypt. However, these places like Mount Bayou, and like I say, it's been around for over 100 years. So you can't argue it is a successful community that
right.
blacks can work together, and they've consistently done it over 100 years. And it started with one person, Isaiah Montgomery, but I'm sure, after he purchased the land, he collaborated with other black folk. And all right, here's a town that we can lay out in the way we want to and build it up from there.
By the time you came along, it was good. Looking at this statue that's there still on the side of the road here, it states that IT worked with his cousin Benjamin T. Green. So as you say, yeah, there was a collaborative effort to do what they did. Yeah, there were other blacks who were like-minded
right.
and worked together to do this from an organized standpoint. They knew what they were striving to do. Yeah.
Right, right. Oh, before I forget, now, people, you listen to Del Mar America, he came up through, it started out when he was young at Mount Bayou, Mississippi, and that's what we're talking about him with today, but he's also in daily contact with Pleasant Stephens, who we've had on here several times. So, Delmar, could you give us an update on Pleasant Stephens and what's going on with him?
Oh, he's still in what we call recovery, getting stronger, getting out more. Have a long way to go, but at least he's not. We were talking the other day with his wife and Tria were talking about it. When he came out of the hospital from this last surgery he had, they actually listed him as a hostage case. And his wife and I, we went in there and had to do battle and went back to his original doctors and had that corrected. So he's off that, and he's on the life back in the get back in, into active life now. So we're happy that he's on the mend and eating well, has a good appetite, and that's a good sign. So things are working that weren't working before. So and all is much, much better.
All right, good, good. Yeah, we've had him on here several times. Segregation now, desegregation. And I guess with Mile Bayou, you got people there that they've got people living in Mile Bayou where they can trace their roots back over, at least back to the founding of the town. But what was desegregation's effect, if any, on Mile Bayou? I mean, because it's still around, but and it's got over 1,500 people, so that's a respectable sized city.
Well, let me tell you some things that happened there after. You say desegregation became the law of the land, and of course you always had blacks who were leaving Mile Bayou, going. They went to Chicago, they went to Detroit, they went to all these other cities. You got people that went north for better promises, etc. Like that, they went somewhere else to find what they wanted in other man's place. Let's say, but when desegregation became the law of the land, a couple of things happened. Two things. The blacks there, particularly the young ones, left Mile Bayou in pursuit of other things, as you say, in other Egypts, in Egypt. And they actually abandoned the town, but what really killed it economically was they rerouted the railroad that went straight down to the town, not in the middle of town, but the highway, 61 Highway Railroad, went down parallel. They were side by side. There were quite some distance between. They weren't right on the other. But the point was, if you went down the highway, you could look to your west, and there was a railroad there. And the main train going all the way from New Orleans, from the Gulf Coast, all the way up to Chicago, wherever that train went there, down north and south every day. So that was a lifeline as far as the economics and all that kind of thing. The train and the main highway, 61 Highway, which is, again, as old as the town itself. So what they did, they rerouted both the main highway and that train route out of Mile Bayou. Now, that took legislation. That took people of authority. That wasn't done by somebody just said, let's just move it. That was done by planning. And that killed the economics of that town. Right now, in fact, I don't know if they're using a gas station in there. So the unfortunately, again, the effort to assimilate, the word I use, into the other communities, into the white community by blacks, has actually weakened that town. And I believe what I heard was that when whites tried to come in to buy portions and land in the town, the blacks in authority would not sell it to them. Mm-hmm. And so I believe that what happened, this is my opinion here, because they were not allowed to come in and perhaps dominate the town if they'd been allowed to, probably had more money, they said, let's kill it. And they killed it by taking the railroad and the highway out.
Okay.
That's what they did. And to this day, again, you can go all the way down to the Gulf Coast and never even see Mile Bayou. You drive right past it. You wouldn't even know it.
Right.
It's rerouted. And, again, the train goes all totally away from it. These things were done, and that was the lifeblood. That was the thing that made Mile Bayou such a powerful strength at that time. Even though it was a black independent community, it had the main highway, U.S. government highway 61, and the railroad, the main railroad, not some little sideline company. They went straight through that town, and now that has been removed, and that town has suffered economically for that reason.
Well, it's still surviving. Like I said, it's got 1,500 people that live there still.
Yeah, my dad lived there till he died. I buried him there. And his widow, they all raised him up. Now, he went to New York.
His wife is from Mile Bayou, too, isn't she?
No, she's from, no, she, not in Mount Valley. She was born, I think, let's see how to go now. She was raised in Benton Harbor.
Okay.
But she does have some kind of family connection down there in Mount Valley. She didn't grow up in Mount Valley. She grew up in Benton Harbor.
All right. Well, Mississippi is an interesting state. Early in the week, we covered a person, the barber of Natchez, and this was a guy born a slave in Natchez, Mississippi. And he bought his freedom. Oh, he was manumitted. And he learned a trade, which was he's a barber. But then he took his profits from being a barber and bought an 800-acre plantation. Had connections to the governor's office in Mississippi. So Mississippi, matter of fact, now I've been in Mississippi maybe about three times at least. One of the places I went to when I was younger was Greenville, Mississippi. And what's interesting about Greenville, Mississippi, there was a colonizing organization called Mississippi and Africa, or either Africa and Mississippi. It's a Wikipedia page on it. And a lot of those people were former slaves who bought their freedom because they were tradespeople. They were barbers, hairdressers, iron workers, they formed, Mississippi and Africa, those former slaves got together and formed the largest community stateside in the United States that had a successful back-to-Africa trip. They organized 300 black folk, and they went to... they chartered a ship over to the west coast of Africa, and they ended up buying at least 2 million acres worth of land. It could have been more than that, but they formed Sonoke County, Liberia, and you can look it up right now today. Fact check me on it. Sonoke County, Mississippi, its origins are from Greenville, Mississippi, which still exists today, and then Greenville, Liberia, was named after Greenville, Mississippi. So it's amazing the resilience and the innovation that came from slaves or former slaves out of the state of Mississippi. And this happened while slavery was all legalized right here in the United States. So it's very interesting.
May I jump in here for a comment?
Sure. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
One of the things that's interesting, and you have to go into black history to find it, because again, my form of education came through the states of Arkansas and Tennessee. I didn't attend the public schools in Mississippi, but I went to Arkansas and Tennessee. Mm. And, of course, the textbooks all left us out. Okay, we went in there. But what's interesting about the black legacy or the black heritage is that Africa, we have been conquering and ruling and building and doing things for thousands of years. We can do anything. We run
right.
Corporate America to this day. We run America. So it's not our ability that we can't do it. The discussion is going to be, why aren't we? What is the disconnect? But we can build and do anything and have done everything that any other form of humanity has done.
Right.
This day, we can do anything.
Right.
Why
oh,
are we doing
let
that?
Me,
that might be the
now, in Mount Bayou, well, you left there young, but was there such a thing as a social services office there in Mount Bayou?
When I was growing up. Now, I'm not questioning your intent, but what do you mean by what social service you have in mind? I think
they didn't have a job, so they need to get food stamps and
No.
Section 8 housing and all that kind of stuff.
Was what's interesting about that, that people were so, industrial orientated. People, you know, to have something, you had to work for it. We didn't have a welfare system. It just wasn't part of, there was no need for it. There was productivity. And when there was a need, people pulled together. First of all, families were stronger, so families kind of took it on. But also the neighbors, again, there was this neighborly thing where you look after it. If an animal got out or something happened or the man got sick and couldn't get a crop, we all pulled together and they did that. So they didn't allow this need to develop to any extent where they had to have some kind of organization.
They didn't have to rely on government.
These so-called social services come in latter day due to political things about, well, you know, the government's supposed to take care of people and all this kind of stuff, and so that has been part of the stream behind how this came on. But no, there was no welfare social agencies and all that because people were independent and we took care of our own. And remember too, churches were stronger then. The black church was a strong part of the community. And again, black churches took care of their own then. That was part of it too. The black church took care of its own then.
I'm glad you qualified that with then. I guess the Mount Bayou philosophy was, like I said, the philosophy that, at the core, listening here, it's that they believe that everything they needed, they can get within themselves or within their community. Whereas and that's why I titled this podcast, and we're on part two of it today, the promised land ain't in Egypt. And it's not in white supremacy. It's not in reparations. It's right within. See, when I hear a story, like the guy who founded Mount Bayou and the people who helped him, okay, because he didn't do it all by himself, is I call that do-it-yourself reparations. You know. The Mount Bayou story does not involve the federal government. It doesn't involve the state government. It doesn't involve local government. You know, they were self-governed people. And they still are.
Right.
And
keep in mind, too, there were permanent white people who wanted to see that successful. They wasn't trying to tear it down and having night raids and burning the place down and trying to stop it. They wanted to see them. Mount Bayou was not a threat to the white community. They didn't see this as something that these blacks get strong, they're going to come and wipe us out. That wasn't part of the belief by anybody. So it wasn't something that was a thorn in the side or a place to be concerned with. You mentioned about the Egypt story. When Israel kept growing in number, the Pharaoh and people say, these people, they're going to outgrow us, and we better put them in bondage before they join sides with our enemies. That was part of the fear that came out of that. But no, Mount Bayou was supported and encouraged and not seen as a threat. And again, did you say they wouldn't reach out for a handout or tell the government come in and do something for us like that? And so, yeah, there was this independence that was part of the belief that Isaiah Montgomery and others had that we're going to be as self-sufficient as we can. And they were.
And I got that on my list. I would like to visit Mount Bayou. And I think anybody listening, visit these towns because for some people, if they don't see it, they're not going to believe it. And I think what's happening to, tragically, a lot of younger black folk in the United States, they've never even heard of these towns. They haven't heard of a Mount Bayou.
I know. You can go 100 miles north, and I'm talking about Memphis because I lived there, grew up there. That was most of my education, high school, college. And blacks, they don't know of it. They haven't heard of it. You can tell them, everybody here from Mount Bayou, I don't know where they had never heard of it. 100 miles away. Never heard of it.
That's crazy.
And again, because it wasn't included in the textbooks and our structured education we grew up in, I mean, the Memphis school public education doesn't include Mount Bayou in any of their textbooks. Nothing about it.
Right.
So if they don't find out from other blacks or from their own culture, it's not even, the term is not even mentioned. It's not even a phrase at all.
Okay.
So
all
it's
right.
out of sight and out of mind. Put it away, out of sight and out of mind. And again,
right.
that's the thing, again, we haven't taught black history, and to my opinion, we still don't. We still don't do enough. And this whole
no.
idea, I'm like Morgan Freeman, Black History Month ought to be laughed off, and I mean, to me, it ought to be Black History 12 months a year, because that's the only way we're going to get another generation to understand who
well,
we are.
There's quite a bit of it out there.
We're going to go forward.
Right. There's quite a
yeah,
bit of it out there. I mean,
yeah,
we can do
yeah.
Mount Bayou alone. You can get 12 months out of the year every year just out of one town alone, and that's just one. The other Mount Bayou's out there, but a lot of people, like I say,
yeah.
it. You know what's interesting? Like I say, it's not a month that goes by that I don't hear nothing about something about Black Wall Street, which was a 40-acre neighborhood in Tulsa, Oklahoma, and people that mm-hmm. tell that story, they come from it from a victim point of view, and then they talk about Rosewood,
yeah.
But nobody has bought. I've never heard of anybody bringing up Mount Bayou or Eatonville or Hopkins Park or Pembroke, Illinois, or Taft, Oklahoma, or there's a bunch of towns, Highland Park, Maryland, Fairmont Heights, Maryland, Princeville, North Carolina. There's about eight, at least around about anywhere from 800 to 1,000 communities like that in the United States. But they constantly bring up those two, and they always bring it up from a victimhood point of view. And a lot of these people have never heard of, you know, the communities like Mount, and today we're featuring Mount Bayou. The only thing they might mention out of Mississippi would be the Emmett Till story that happened
yeah,
in
Popper's, yeah.
In Money, Mississippi.
57. Yeah, go there.
But you know what? I don't think that could have happened in Mount Bayou.
No white people lived in Mount Bayou. If Emmett Till had gone there, but he couldn't have been accused of whispering to a white woman. It couldn't have happened. There wasn't a white woman there to whisper at. None. Period.
Touché. Case closed.
Kind of black on black crime. That kind of stuff wasn't part of the culture. Yeah, we had fights and stuff, but again, that just wasn't part of it. It was just like, as someone said, it was just kind of unheard of. It just wasn't a problem.
Right.
That wasn't it.
Well, you brought up a good point. In Mount Bayou, there were no white women.
Nope.
That eliminates that problem right there. And the merchants in Mount Bayou were black.
All black, that's right.
All black. People, if you get a chance and you visit Mississippi, when I get there, I like to visit those satellite towns you talked about, too.
Yeah, they're there still.
Yeah, because those places, like I say, the ones I've experienced, Blackjack, Oklahoma, I've looked on the internet, haven't run across anything yet, but it is physically there because I've been in it a few times.
I don't think those little towns I mentioned are even on the map. If you pull up the map of that area of Mississippi, I doubt if you'd even see those towns listed.
And places like that is what I call the real United States. They're in the real United States of America, where you can go in and build the kind of life you want to live. And because I know, when I was in Taft, and I've shared this story on here a few times. You know, it was kind of stuffy in there because the house hadn't been open in a while. I had to open up the front door. I opened up the front door. You know, it was screened and everything. But I slept with the front door to the house wide open, zero fear for like 3 or 4 consecutive nights in a row. You know.
Well, let me tell you this real quick story. Even L.A., even as early as the late 70s and 80s, I built a house in Dyersburg, Tennessee.
Mm-hmm.
But the house we lived in on the next street there, we didn't, nobody locked their doors even then. That was in 78, 79, 80.
Okay.
It was a community. It was a horseshoe, but nobody locked their doors.
Mm-hmm.
Black community, black neighborhood. Nobody locked their doors.
Mm. One last question before we go to the phone, because I'm sure we got people that want to ask you some questions. Police. What was your memory of the police back when you were, growing up in Mount Bayou?
And that's interesting. That's interesting. Now, 61 is a state highway.
Mm-hmm.
So you had your state trooper. And I remember seeing him in and out of there because that was his patrol, that highway section. And I never saw a black one. I saw the white state trooper. But as far as any incident involving the black police in Mount Bayou during my growing up or during my visit, did I ever hear of anything? So if there was, I don't know anything about it. I can't draw on that. But the state police was a part of that community because that was a state highway. 61 is a state highway, and therefore you had the highway state trooper, and he could be seen there from time to time. But again, what's interesting also about it was that there was a respect. As far as if blacks got in trouble somewhere else and they got to Mount Bayou where they lived, that was like a sanctuary. Didn't mean they could get away with the crime, but they wouldn't go come in and drag them out in the middle of the night and lynch them. That didn't happen.
Right.
Yeah, again,
right.
This was a black community. There was
see,
this,
and
was
that's
respect.
Why
and
I
whatever
consider
the
place
was,
like, that's why I consider places
yeah,
like Mount Bayou.
No,
that's why I named this podcast "The Promised Land Ain't in Egypt." Mount Bayou is a promised
again,
land.
The going back to the Rosewood community, now Rosewood was not a all black community, right?
No, it was integrated.
No,
they had 10 to 15.
No, okay, right. So
they had 10 to 15 black households in that was it in Rosewood. And when they burnt it down, they burnt everybody's houses down. White folks too.
Right. So, but the thing started, according to the movie, I don't know, I guess they would have some history to it. The white woman accused the black man of doing something, right? Now,
yeah,
that
started everything, yeah.
Right. So you didn't have that kind of crime threat. Well, some white woman said some black man did it, not Mount Bayou, that's what's going to happen. Didn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
So that took care of those kind of potential happening because you didn't have that confused community there.
And you know what? I would call that a line of defense because if you have a community and these people that got together with Informed Mount Bayou, and I talk about chess a lot, I would call that a chess move. Let's have a community where nobody can be accused of violating a white person, male or female. I'm sure, and that's a line of defense, and that line of defense has worked in Mount Bayou for over 100 years. That's worked there, you know. So now I know in another town in Oklahoma that I was in, I heard what one of the stories was. At one time they had a sign. It's not there anymore, but no white people allowed in this town after sundown. And that was a sundown town reverse strategy, where it wasn't a majority white town, it was a all black town that had that posted sign, no white folks allowed in this town after sundown. So, like I said, and these promised lands could be done today. New ones can be put up today, or you can just go to a historical one. And Martin Luther King's, and I'm not downing him or nothing like that, but I just find it interesting. Maybe Martin Luther King, Jesse Jackson, Al Sharpton, I understand that Medgar Evers did know about Mount Bayou, Mississippi, and I guess he did visit there. But I would like to interview his wife. Why didn't he live there? Because they shot him down in Egypt at his home in front of his children on the front lawn. So it just seemed like, and it was very turbulent back then, whereas at Mount Bayou, it's an oasis.
Well, again, you didn't have any racial tension there because, you know, remember the era of what we call the civil rights movement, that time was a tension field anyway, you know.
Right.
That was a whole different culture of people thinking. Blacks were pushing to demand more of what we should have had because we built this nation, et cetera. And then there were whites who were saying, no, you're not getting none of it. You can't have it. You got to stay in your place like you've been since slavery ended. So that was a different tension. In Mile High, you didn't have no tension of trying to take something.
No, because they had Mile High, you had their own. Yeah,
had
Mount
their
Bayou,
that's right.
Had
now you
their
did.
Own.
Remember that you could go anywhere else in the white community, buy anything else you didn't have. Wasn't no you can't have it. So you had it there in your own town for yourself. That's
mm-hmm.
right.
And before I go to these phone lines, let's see. What now? But hold it. King had I know he had a famous march. Did he have any famous marches in Mississippi? I know he had them in Alabama.
I can't name a Mississippi town. That doesn't mean it didn't happen.
I don't
right
think
now
I'm looking
mind.
At a map of Mississippi now, and I can't. Because Montgomery is in Alabama.
Alabama. And the bridge and all that, yeah. Selma. All most of that is Alabama, Selma. Most of it was Alabama, I think, was the most noted
right.
southern state that had the thing. Yeah. Then you had some other activities by the Freedom Riders, some other things that happened in the state of Mississippi, but not from a town standpoint, I don't think.
Now, here's one thing I don't get. Now, while King and the Civil Rights Movement and whatever they were, in Southern Christian, I don't know, anyway, they were protesting the bus line in Montgomery or somewhere, one of those places. Whereas, all right, they had the money and they had the talent pool. Why didn't they go off like Isaiah Montgomery and many others and say, you know what, instead of marching and protesting, and, you know, to sit on somebody else's bus, why don't we just start our own town with our own bus line?
I think I can answer that. My opinion.
That's
remember
where I put it
now,
out.
You're talking, you're talking from the 1800s, as far as Mile High and other towns, to the 1950s. Okay, now here's the difference. Now remember, blacks helped build Montgomery. We had already put our sweat, blood, and money into those towns. So when
right.
going back to Rosa Parks, she was paying the same price as the white folks. But they're telling her, you got to move to the back and stand up. When I grew up in Arkansas, same thing. You had to stand up and get a white man a seat. I lived those days. But you paid the price for the seat.
Right.
So finally they're saying, hey, if we're paying the price, why can't we have the same rights? So the civil rights movement is about why can't we have what we helped to build and are being taxed for? You paid the same taxes. You go up down the highway. You remember there was no roadside stop. You had to go to the woods when you travel the highway to go do your stuff. But you paid the same price for everything. So that's what the civil rights will say. Hey, we blood and sweat and all. We built this country. We paid the taxes. We still pay the taxes. We believe, according to your laws, we should have the same opportunity to enjoy the blessings. So that was the difference between what King and some were saying then versus that thought was not a part of the 1800 post-Civil War thought. No, we definitely okay. not. We have our own. We build our own. Mount Vine was part of that product of that. We built our own. There was no place at Black Hill. We built this, so give us a part of it. No, that wasn't the case.
All right. Well, I got a little bit clearer understanding on that. Let's go to the phone lines real quick here. 314, your mic is open.
You know, the population in Mount Bayou now is 2,010. And the per capita is 12,000. The median is 22,000. And you have 95% of the population make less than $50,000 a year. So it would be a nice place to visit, but I don't think most people go on and live there. You know, one thing that Mount Bayou, you can take 55 south to 20, 61, then 278 on down to Mount Bayou, according to the map. But if I was to go down there and for some sightseeing, I would want to go to Indianola. That's where Fannie Lou Hamer made her famous speech with the Democratic Mississippi Democratic Party. But other than that,
I've heard of that place. I don't know much about it. You say Indianola, Mississippi?
Yeah, it's right off
Indianola,
of Mount
Bayou. Mississippi is south of Mount Bayou. Just a little bit, not that far. It's off of Highway 82. Yeah, well, the kids ain't going to move down there to that town. But like you say, it's a town that somebody wants to develop, like many of them. You got Cleveland. You got towns all around there. You even got an airport, Delta Regional Airport. I tell you what, my grandson get his license, we'll fly down there to Florida and pick you up and bring you over here, and we can visit Mount Bayou. I don't know what we're going to do with a rental car. You got stores there. You got Walmart Supercenter. Of course, the dollar stores. You got all kinds of Walmart stores. Pardon me?
In Cleveland, you got everything. You have everything in Cleveland. That's the white town. When they bypassed the highways and the railroad, they went back. They looped around and went back into Cleveland. Cleveland has everything you want. It's in Cleveland, Mississippi.
Well, I can see why they done. They put 55. They ran 55 in the high areas to stay away from them lakes, streams, and going over toward the Mississippi, which is west of Mount Bayou. That's why they chose to go east of Mount Bayou, because you got higher elevation. You didn't have to worry about all them damn waterways and that.
Well, there is a levee there.
Yeah, but I wouldn't want the highway. I wouldn't want that highway. I got a friend of mine, my neighbor of mine, who's was from Clarksville, Mississippi. And that's just a little bit away from Mount Bayou. So it's not that many people in the school from 7 to 12 only got about 250 students. So that would be a good adventure for you. In a way, you could start your own town.
Yeah, and I think another reason why, now I don't know, and I think you started to mention it. I have a friend of mine, she's mid-30s, somewhere around there. She lives in the DMV up in, D.C. area, and she's looking for, she lives 10 miles away from her job. She makes pretty good money. Matter of fact, she makes more money than her mother, probably makes more than her father, and might make more than her grandfather.
Where she live at in D.C., you say?
Well, she lives in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C., she works works for a university. But she lives in a room. Now, she's looking for a house. And everything she's – time to this. She's looking for a house in the – in condo apartments you know, she's getting looking at things at $250,000, $275,000. So what I've told her, which I know she hasn't agreed to it, but I said, well, look, why don't you don't be stuck on just 10 miles from your job. You know, you might want to look at Western Maryland or going to West Virginia. It might be an hour outside your job or whatever. But, you know, you can find a house dramatic. Like, for instance, she ran across something that was a fixer-upper in Hagerstown, Maryland, which is about an hour from her job, for $55,000. Now, it's a fixer-upper. You need a little work to it. But it was $55,000. But she's got, in my opinion, an Egypt state of mind. So how does this relate to what we're talking about today? So are a lot of younger people, the millennials or Generation X, are they willing to move to a Mount Bayou, Mississippi?
No.
They like the comfort and conveniences of a Jackson.
No, it ain't that.
You don't think
no,
so?
No, it's not that. You know why come they not going to move to Mount Bayou? There's no economy in Mount Bayou. Kids nowadays going to school, getting college education, whatever major, they're not going to be living in. What does Mount Bayou have to offer? The per capita is $12,000. No, the biggest employers there is Walmart and Dollar General. I mean, you know the kids, the young people. My grandson's classmate went to Jackson State. He didn't stay there in Mississippi. He went to Texas. Where the work is at? Where the demand is at? And they're in Dallas. I mean, everybody's running from those areas.
I'm running too. Now, Pianchi, what do you think about telecommuters and the digital nomad people?
What do you mean by telecommuters?
You got $12,000. They can work by with their laptop.
Yeah, but how many people going to do that, Ellie? Now, Mount Bayou would be a good place to retire after you made a living up north and gathered a pension that comes in every month. This is substantial. Move down to Mount Bayou and build a home.
Well, that is an option.
It's the same thing that we see going on in Florida. You still in Florida, aren't you?
Yeah, but in Florida, you got to stay away, in my opinion, stay away from Dade County. That's Miami, Orlando, Tampa, St. Pete, Jacksonville, Tallahassee. Stay away from those places and go to the rural parts of, Florida. But
if you move to those cities I just named,
it's too expensive.
Yeah. Yeah, you got retirees that live in Florida. I took my daughter to the Disney World.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that was that time. Anyway, the hotel I stayed in, they had tours going to look at future development. So me and my wife, we took a ride over there. They fed us lunch and everything, and we went and looked at the development. But that was for retirees, not young people that's making a living. So that's just the way it is, man.
That's true, and then a lot of the younger of the workforce, the people that you're naming, they're addicted to the comfort and conveniences of the big city.
That's where the jobs are. Jobs associated with
big
cities.
Yeah, that's where the living is. That's where the money is. That's where the economy is. That's right. There is no economy in Mount Bayou. Nothing there to make a living off of. Not right. Not at all. No. You could go
unless
to Cleveland or some other town, but not in Mount Bayou.
Well, I had to do my research on it because you have a lot of people today that they're telecommuters. If they got their laptop or their smartphone, that's their office also. Now, how many of those people out there, I don't know. I don't know the statistics on that. I got to do my homework on that. But not every job you can telecommute. You're not going to work at Popeye's Chicken or Walmart and telecommute. You have to physically go into those locations. Right. Plumbers and electricians and many of the STEM people, they can't telecommute. They have to physically go in. So, yeah, you're right, Bianca, on that. Let's see, 407 area code, your mic is open.
Good afternoon, gentlemen, brothers, kings, whatever you want to call yourself. This is Bianca with Health and Wellbeing on Friday morning and Soul Purpose Healing on Sunday night. And what is it about this Mississippi town that you all were talking about? I'm sorry I came in late, but the question is, what's near this town?
Well, Del Mar, that's in your ball.
Cleveland is the closest productive town. So you got anything in Cleveland. If you go north of Mount Valley, you have Shelby. And, of course, you can go another 50 miles. You've got Clarksdale, which is where Morgan Freeman's from. So those are some of the close towns right there on the 61 Highway. But like,
so are they
Winstonville
an hour
and Marigold.
How far away are they from this town? What is it, Mount Bayou?
Yeah, Mount Bayou, Mississippi.
Yes, Mount Bayou.
How far is the nearest major town from Mount Bayou?
5 minutes. Cleveland, 5 minutes.
Huh?
5 minutes.
5 minutes.
So what's the problem with Mount Bayou?
Just right. Well, it take a while. To that's another subject.
Yeah, that's another. You know, it depends on who you talk to. What's the problem? But matter of fact, Viotta, you're in a good. All right, let's move to geography. Viotta's in Florida, and she's not too far from a historic black township, Eatonville, Florida. Now, Eatonville, Florida is 6 miles away from Orlando, Florida. So, Viotta, me and you together have been to, Eatonville at least 2 times. So, in your opinion, because you've got 2 sons, which are, I guess, Generation X or Millennials, one of the two. You're a grandmother. Would Eatonville be a good fit for young adults your children's age?
It depends on what the people are looking for, because Eatonville's kind of saturated as far as real estate, and they'd have to – I don't think there's a lot of open land, so they'd either be renting or buying a house there, but it's saturated in terms of building something new there. My thought is Mount Bayou, why wouldn't somebody want to live there if 5 minutes away is a major city? If you're out of the urban,
again,
toxic, congested environment, why wouldn't you want to live there?
Because what you call a major city is about 2,000 people. What you call a major city is about 2,000 people. Mount Bayou population is about 2,000. 2,000.
It's not like Orlando. Yeah, because, Eatonville's got, is small, but 1,000 to 2,000. Less than 2,000 people at Eatonville. However, Orlando and the Orlando metro area is large.
But that's what my question is. Why are you all saying nobody wants to live in Mount Bayou?
I didn't say
because
that.
I'm saying that young people don't want to live there because there's nothing to do, Rayada.
But if the commute is – I'm asking what's the closest major city where they can work or do something and then go back to Mount Bayou? How far away do they have to go to be able to do something and get culture or whatever they need?
Probably going to Memphis.
Well,
that's
he said 5 minutes.
That's a stretch.
All right, he said,
Memphis, 100 miles.
One town. Yeah. You know what, that's a very subjective question because – when you said do something, Viotta, all right, because then that can include recreation, it could include going to the movies, it include museums or what have you. You know, that's very subjective on who you're talking to. Some people are happy with an internet connection and Netflix. They're good to go. Other people want to get out
and
go to Some people, like, well, you live in Orlando. So your grandchildren, I mean, are pretty active. I mean, you know, well, you know what's in Orlando.
They don't have any internet connections in Mount Bayou, because I know they don't have any Clarks. I believe it's Clark. My friend complained about it.
Mount Bayou's got to have an internet connection there.
No, because you ain't got no population.
No,
you got places in Mississippi.
Tampa, Oklahoma's got internet, and they got 300 people.
Yeah, but who are they close to?
If
you go down the highway, they do have the towers so your cell phone can work, but they do not have the internet option that you find in a metropolis like, again, a major city. No, they don't have that. You cannot click on anything and get it what you want. That's another drawback.
You live there?
I grew up there for a while, and I visited there since. Mount Bayou has no out here. You drove down and looked at it, you want to keep driving. It doesn't appeal to you from the eye standpoint. It's a dead town. It doesn't look like anybody want to live there.
Why are we talking about this dead town?
Because the name of the title of the podcast today is The Promised Land Ain't in Egypt. It talks about...
That's one of L.A.'s.
In other words, if you want to, in my opinion, now this is very subjective, in my opinion, if you're younger or older, in my opinion, it doesn't matter what age, if you want to get ahead of the game, you need to go to a small rural community where the cost of living is dramatically lower, everything's lower. You won't have the comfort and conveniences of a large town, but you can get into a small town and get ahead of the game economically. Now, that's my subjective opinion.
Some young, conscious, eco-friendly person would have to create a new something in Mount Bayou, a new community, because it don't offer, at least it doesn't have a lot of technology that you have to maneuver whatever through. But if somebody wanted to live there, they'd have to have a really creative mind and try and figure out, well, what's needed in this area, not just in Mount Bayou, but what's needed in this area that I can create for people to have a better life. That's what this is all about. You know, how can you create something to improve the lives of the people in that area? That would be my interest if I were young.
Let's take the town as it is right now. It's over 100 years old, so number one, they must be doing something right in that aspect. Number two, due to the fact that there's less consumption in that town, you have people that are looking for communities like that. If you go to Orlando,
there's only 2,000 people. They don't have no metropolitan sewer. They don't have no metropolitan water. Don't have no internet.
A lot of people are looking for communities like that.
Yeah, there are conscious people. Your tiny house dwellers are more like the people who would go there, because they don't care. They want to be off the grid, so they don't care about all the.
So you're saying they're looking for a non-internet connection? Hey, we wouldn't be talking to each other if it wasn't for that
now. I've got, like, on my phone, I got roaming with my plan. All right, so I can go to Mount Bayou, and I still got an internet connection. The municipal,
water. I'm from down there. Yes, that's right.
I don't want any municipal service.
Download movies so you can watch TV and see news.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want municipal service. That's just me.
Well, that's you.
And
all
the people like me.
You can't say you in one voice, then reality is talking about young people. Young people want those things.
All right. I don't know the percentages, but a lot of tiny houses are young folk. We're talking about millennials, some Generation Z.
That's young white folks.
Matter of fact,
stuff, man.
Matter of fact, let me put the travel
yes, they
blog.
They are doing that stuff, Bianchi. Black people are doing that stuff. They're waking up.
So
they're
you say you got an abundance of young blacks that's building tiny homes.
Hold on. If you go, I'm using YouTube as a barometer. If you go on YouTube and look up, I think this is the best barometer for this. Black or white, travel bloggers. You've got people in their 20s. That have been to every nation on this planet, 195 countries. How did they do it? Number one, they don't have a car note. Number two, they don't have a mortgage. A lot of these people that are millennials and Generation Z and some Generation X's, they're not getting in. They're looking at their parents and grandparents and saying, you know what? I'm not getting into a consumer debt trap like my parents or grandparents. So they
would
love to move my body to Mississippi.
How many tens of thousands of people are you talking about?
I don't know about 10, but there's no shorter videos on YouTube of these people.
Yeah, well,
black
that's the exception. That's not the norm.
Viada, there are people, let's take Viada's demographic. I believe there's a lot of women in Viada's demographic, and Viada's a grandmother. All right, she's lived in the big house. She's lived in a house with a nice-sized house with a pool. She's living in California. She's in Orlando right now. She's on her second tiny house. There's a bunch of people in her demographic that would love to live the kind of lifestyle where she lives, where the expenses
are lower.
What I'm saying
is that they ain't going to move to Mount Bayou because there's nothing there. Brooklyn, Illinois is right across from Missouri, St. Louis.
Let's complete that sentence, Bianchi. Let's complete that sentence. There's nothing in Mount Bayou to consume.
There's nothing there for
services. In New York City, when you say services, Bianchi, I'm thinking the government has got their hand out. I want to go to a place where the government doesn't have his hand out as much.
Yeah, but if your child gets sick, where do you take them?
Hey, we can have a clinic in town. And then I don't know everything
wait
about
a minute.
My body.
Hang on for a second. Wait a minute. Let's talk about this. So you can have a clinic in town. Look at your school in Mount Bayou. From the 7th grade to the 12th grade, you got 230 students. So you're saying that somebody's going to build a clinic. Hang on for a sec. You're saying somebody's going to build a clinic and just sit around all day long, all week long, all month long, waiting for somebody to come in and need a Band-Aid. That ain't going to happen, Ellie.
Well, we have to do some research in that community. What's the age demographic? So you have a lot of elderly people. The elderly people.
I just told you the age demographic. From the 7th grade to 12th grade is about 230,000 students.
My body's over 100 years old. So they've had people in those 100-plus years that have had every kind of medical emergency or whatever, and the town's still there. So
and
I don't know what they're doing there, but they're doing something.
And they died. I ain't down in the place. It'd probably be a good place for you to retire.
I get what you're saying. If we took the critical mass of black people or just the average American, you are 100% right. They're not going to move to a town the size of Mount Bayou. They're not going to do it because, in my opinion, they are addicted to the comfort and conveniences of what a big town or municipality
I tell you somebody else ain't going to move there too, L.A., and that's you. You talk about this all the time. You're going to stay there in Florida about that big city where you had those conveniences. You ain't going to take no trip to no Mount Bayou with Bill, no home. You're not going to no Kimberly. Where is Kimber at? North Carolina? That land that used
Viada.
To be. They about
Viada
to lose
now,
that land because of taxes.
Ziada, now, you, Ziada, you're the only person on this line that's been up to the 4 acres. What's up there on the 4 acres?
What 4 acres?
You know, the 4 acres.
That's right outside Chicago, ain't it?
No, no, no. Down here in Florida.
No, I don't. I can't see.
There's no infrastructure there at all, other than a dirt road. That's it.
4 acres are you talking about?
My 4 acres.
Oh, yeah. And where is it?
Jasper? In Jasper. Yeah. It's a dirt road there. That's it.
You know, there's a town outside of Chicago. What is at that Kimber Estates or something that black woman that was talking about getting blacks to move there to help revitalize it?
You talking about Hopkins Park?
Jackson. Huh?
You talking about Hopkins Park, Illinois?
No, it's not. It's Kimber something. Oh, anyway, Jesse Jackson went there and had a meeting and was accusing racism because they didn't have no pressurized water. Well, the people in the town have to put the pressurized water in, not the state.
Are you talking about an independent water system?
It doesn't have to
like a
water company for a water company to bring in potable water, pressurized water. It has to be able to reap the cost for all that, and it's just not enough people in that area. Like I told you before, Brooklyn, Illinois, right across the street, right across the river from St. Louis. Ain't no blacks moving to Brooklyn. All they got to do is go across the Sam Houston Bridge and you'd be in downtown St. Louis. No blacks is moving in Brooklyn, not from Missouri. And people that stay in Venice, people that stay in Granite City, they ain't coming there. It ain't nothing there.
Let me throw out this stat, okay? And Trump was elected on this. 47% of the population of the United States lives in towns that have a population of maybe 10,000 people or less. And a part of that, there are only 10 towns in the United States that have a population of 1 million or more people. So there's a whole bunch of Mount Bayou. There are more Mount Bayou Mississippis than New York City. And that's why I call a place like Mount Bayou, Mississippi, the real United States of America.
But they come to the major city to work. Every day, people come across those bridges from Illinois into St. Louis, and even going out further in St. Louis County.
Most do.
They come to work.
You're absolutely right. Most do. And then there's a lot of jobs that, like we already talked about this already, that you can't telecommute. But put it this way, I don't see my bayou becoming a ghost town anytime soon, or any other town like that.
It's practically already a ghost town now, L.A. You only got 2,000 people in there. Well, let's put it like this. You only got 250 kids in the schools.
But Piyaki, does everything have to be big in the United States?
Well, yeah. It's your,
can people appreciate a small town?
A good indication of where your town is going to be in 20 years is look at what you have in your school system. If you ain't got but 250 kids, according to this, what they're reading here, those kids, when they grow up, what are they going to do? They're going to replace 200 and some odd people that died. So your population is not going to increase. Do you guys know how to do demographics?
I do.
Think.
Like I say, over half, nearly half of the towns in the United States are small towns. There's only 10 that have a population of 1 million or more.
St. Louis Public School District. I remember when it was over 100,000 in their schools. Now it's down less than 20,000, about 19,000 students in a major metropolitan area. Detroit used to have over 670 blacks in that city. Now they down to half that amount. Their school system is less than 50,000. People are moving out of those areas, but they come back to work.
Well, I can't dispute that. Hold on, Pianki. 410 area code. If my board 410 area code, your mic is open.
Hotel Brother LA and all of the rest of the people that are on your podcast. Is the gentleman from Mound Bayou still there?
He's still here.
Yes, I am.
Are you familiar with T.R.M. Howard? They used to live in Mound Bayou.
Yes, I am.
Could you give us a rundown on the impact he had on that community?
Yes, and the white folks ran him out. Yep. Mm-hmm. Came to Chicago. Finished his practice.
Yeah, Delmar, he wanted to know what kind of impact did he have on that community?
Well, again, he had a good impact because Dr. Howard, his office, which he was a doctor, and when you went there, you had, just from the experience, he had the monkeys, goldfish. I mean, there were several things you would see there in his office and the whole setup that you just weren't exposed to just anywhere in the community. And, of course, he was a active civil rights person, and I'm not sure what he was promoting at the time. But he did, the white folks did run him out of Mississippi. Now, I don't know the details on that since he was practicing Mound Bayou. But, yeah, he had a positive input and came on to Chicago to finish his practice, whatever. But, yeah, he was an active black leader in Mound Bayou.
And also, could you give me a rundown on the fraternal order of the, Mount Tabor Fraternal Order, ever what it was in the hospital they built there?
The Tiborian, I think I'm saying it right, hospital was there when I grew up. They closed it down, and in the early 80s, in fact, my father died in the hospital in Mount Bayou in 87. That was a rebuilt hospital. So there was at least two. But that Tiborian hospital, again, that was one of those independent things we had there for ourselves. That was our own hospital. We didn't have to go someplace else. So that was a successful, independent hospital that Mound Bayou had its own hospital. That's right. And again,
well,
the one that my father died in. Pardon?
Yeah, I just asked you that question because, I was reading T.R.M. Howard's bio, and he did quite a bit in that town, and I didn't know whether you were familiar with it or not. He had an insurance company there and a 1,000-acre farm, and he had a lot of other things there, and I didn't know whether you were familiar with all of that or not.
Well, again, I left there when I was like 11. I went back and visited back and forth as an adult because my father stayed down there. In fact, he died down there. So most of my time was visiting, but I did do reading and research, but it wasn't like I lived it as an adult. I did not live there as an adult. I lived there at age 11 and went to Arkansas and Tennessee. But, again, I did do some reading, and am I familiar with that. But that hospital was there. It was thriving. And, again, the one that was there in 87 was there. It was also functioning. My father died there. So I don't know what the status is there. I haven't been back down there in 30-some years since I was down there, actually.
Well, I read that hospital served the communities and the surrounding communities for years. So, I was just wondering if it was still there or not.
I don't know
if
it's probably online. If I can answer that, was there or not.
Well, that's all I had, because it was a very interesting conversation that you had before I got on about these small towns. But, if you don't have vision, then
the small towns make up the United States of America. Like I said, there's only 10. The United States has 19,500 municipalities, and I'm not including, I don't know how many towns are like the other towns that are unincorporated that Delmar mentioned, but there are 19,500 municipalities. Only 10 of them have a population of a million or more people, 47%. Donald Trump got elected president of the United States through small town America. That electoral vote, that's small town America.
Yeah, but Brother L.A., you have to have a magnet to draw people into those towns, just like the big city as a magnet, like an industry or some type of facility or something like that. You know, I understand what you're saying, and I hear what the other callers are saying, but the thing is, if you don't have a bunch of people to make the investment, to put up something, to draw a younger crowd in, a younger working crowd in, then those towns are not going to survive and they're not going to thrive. And I'm going to give you a point. Where I live at, it's a bunch of small towns. But what happened is years ago, they put military bases around in one sector of the area. And what happened is it keeps a lot of young people here because what happened is that those military bases draws a lot of people, and plus it brings in a lot of young Marines. Now, in a town like Mound Bayou and the towns that you're looking at in Oklahoma, if you don't have some people to come in that knows how to look at the area and figure out what they can put in there to draw a bunch of people there, then what happens is you aren't going to get them. And I'm going to give you a case in point. How big was Orlando before Disney World got there? Wasn't nothing but swamps, wasn't it?
That's what I hear.
But the thing is, now it's a thriving metropolis, because the thing is, Disney World brings people in all over the world. But before that, it was just a dusty, small, hick town before Walt Disney came in and bought up all of that property. And those are the type of things that you have to have. But if you don't have a bunch of people with vision that wants those places to survive, then you're just preaching, you're just spitting in the wind. And I'm sad to say that to you, but that's just the way it is.
Well,
and I'll get off the rest of them too on that.
Yeah, let's look at this aspect of it too. I'll use the house in D.C. And this is because generations are connected. All right, my house, not my house, but my next door neighbor we're no longer next door neighbors. She's 101 years old. Her kids put her in a nursing home. Why, I don't know. But they sold her house earlier this year in 2022. They sold it for over $500,000. I don't know the exact number, but over $500,000. Now, she's generation, she would be part of the GI generation because she's 101 years old. She's got one daughter that's probably part of the baby boomer one generation. Her other son, he's a part of the baby boomer generation two. And then she's got generation Z's, X's, and millennials. All right. When she sold that house in Washington, D.C., which has been gentrified, okay, it was in high school, D.C. used to be 70% plus black, now it's 43% and shrinking black. So she sold that house for $500,000. Average person that's entering into the game of home ownership in Washington, D.C., who's Generation Z, Generation X, or millennials, okay, the average people in those generations don't have $500,000 liquid to become a homeowner in D.C., Boston, Chicago, Atlanta, Orlando, Miami, Los Angeles. I can keep on going. So if they can't, matter of fact, at the beginning of this podcast, I talked about one of my friends that she lives in Montgomery County, Maryland, which is a suburb of Washington, D.C. Her job's in D.C. She earns more than both her parents and grandfather. She earns over $50,000 a year, and she rents a room. And she's been looking for houses for the last 2 years, and she's coming up with a condo apartments that are $250,000, $275,000. I say, and that's what she needs. Making over, I said, look, go to, Western Maryland, or go to West Virginia, go to a small market and find something that's $50,000 or less and get into the game that way. So these towns that you're talking about, these small towns, as Pleasant Stephens said on here over 3 or 4 years ago. To live in these larger towns in the United States, you've got to be wealthy. Once again, name a collective group of Generation Z. We're talking about 20-year-olds, millennials, 20 and 30-year-olds, and Generation X, who have $500,000 as a to have the money to buy a starter home.
Brother LA, before your boy get in there, let me give you this. Where I live at, people are doing the exact same thing you're talking about, but they're retirees. They're selling their homes in New York, New Jersey, and the upper northeastern part, and they're coming down here with $600,000 and $700,000, and they're building the same house for $100,000. But now these are retirees. They
right.
made their money. And what they're doing is they're investing the rest of it. But like I stated earlier, if it weren't for the government around D.C., you wouldn't have D.C. If it weren't for the auto industry in Detroit, you wouldn't have had the city of Detroit. You have to have something, a magnet-type operation to draw people in. Now, I looked at the map in Oklahoma, where you talk about all the time. There's about 50
right.
black towns in a circumference of less than what? 50 miles. Now, if someone was able to go in and put something in there, like a industry, or put something like an entertainment operation like Disney World, then those towns could survive. But you don't have people with vision in these little towns. You have people that are saying what they can't do, and most of them don't have the skills and the sophistication to come in and say, well, look, we can do this in this area and invest in this area. And that's why these small towns are drying up. You heard that in the earlier conversation before I got up here, what people talking about what you can't do and what can't be done and everything else, but you got to have people with money and a vision and willing to risk that money in order for these small towns to survive. And I'll let my brother get in here and talk.
Piyaki, you got the mic.
Well, you said the right thing right there. You said she sold a house for $500,000.
Yeah. And, you know, and that $500,000 will be exhausted within 36 to 60
Oh, wait a
months.
Minute. Hang on. Let me get to the point. Why is she waiting to sell for $1.5 million?
I don't know.
I can
all
tell
I
you
know
why.
Is, okay, I'm listening. I'm listening.
Because it ain't going to get up that high. That's the house she paid, what, $50,000 for?
Oh, no.
And she sold for $500,000.
She bought that house over 60 years ago for something like $17,000, $18,000.
Well, then I'm going to tell you something. You better take that $500,000 and run. Get the hell out of there. That's what it's all about anyway. And nobody's going to be, you know, before Walt Disney decided to move down there to develop down in Orlando, he was going to develop in St. Louis, right where the Arch is.
Okay.
You know why couldn't he even do it? Because numbers and demographers said it wouldn't be feasible at the time. People with private money is not going to waste their money in areas where it's not going to make money. I tell you another place. Come on up 55 towards St. Louis to Illinois and cut on over from Sykeson over to Cairo, Illinois, where Reverend Cohen tried to turn that into an economic paradise.
Mm-hmm.
I told you, you had my friend on here, Sterling Moody, where the U.S. Department of Agriculture was offering him $10 million, and not him directly, was offering $10 million for a feasibility plan to turn Cairo from a food desert into something where people could buy food. Well, upon doing the studies say it just ain't feasible. It's just not feasible, even if the government, and see, only the government could offer that kind of capital to develop that in the summer. People that
mm-hmm.
has the money, private investors, not going to do it because they know that it's not no return. If you can't do it with public money, you surely ain't going to do it with private money.
Okay. Well, Del Mar, you got the last word of the day, and thank you for coming on and staying with us for this 2.5, we've been on for a while. Delmar, I'll let you have the last word. Anything you're promoting or any updates?
Well, last word about Mount Valley is, again, it's the history of a trend that I don't know when it started, that we have pursued a social agenda of assimilation. Blacks want to be, as your other gentleman said, where the action is, where the lights are flashing, the money is there. That's where we're going to go, and the generation of young folks, that's where they're heading. They're not looking for no Mound Bayou or any other place that doesn't have what the metropolis main cities are. That is the trend of our nation right now. And if you were talking about where to go future-wise, as you both two gentlemen have said, you have to look at the facts of where the trends are. And if there's anything that could be done at Mound Bayou, if someone had the money, as one gentleman said, the vision, turn to a retirement town, we need to go down and put $10 billion in it just to set it up so it has some kind of appeal. That's my opinion. So, but it's a good history to look at, to understand where we come from. And I believe if we don't know where we come from and how we got here, we're not going to be able to say where we're going or make a decision about where we're going. I know where we're going, but if we don't make a decision based on understanding how we got here, then we're just going to end up someplace. Even the Israelites that left Egypt, they had a destination. They weren't just out there wandering around and trying to find a place. They knew exactly where they were going, and, of course, they're still there now. So, again, appreciate the opportunity to share what I know. I'm not
sure. Now, Delmar, is there any contact information that you want to put out there, people or want to reach out to? Because you're up in Chicago now, but I believe you're headed back to Tennessee.
If you wanted to reach me for further questions, I'm at 800-524-7151. I am founding Fam Passion Showtime Reunion. Has to do with family reunions. We're building that. They have some questions on there. If you call that number, you have a question, you can leave information, and I can follow up on what we're doing with Fam Passion Showtime Reunion in America. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for being on here with us. We held you up here for like 2 hours a day at least. And then thanks
glad
for giving us an update on Pleasant Stephens, who I hear his voice once or twice a week. Thanks to you.
Yeah.
Yeah, so.
Okay. Thank you, sir.
All right,
thanks for having me on. Appreciate it.
Thank you all for calling and listening. Everyone have a good weekend.